Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Well, this is the Federalist Society's Full Employment Act, because I'm to introduce a man who really doesn't need an introduction. But I will make just two observations. First, as most of you know, Justice Scalia is one of the most articulate and forceful defenders of textualism and originalism that we have in this country. And the work he has done on the bench and in classrooms and in his writings really has made a difference, though obviously there's more to be done. Many people have observed that legislative history is in much less high regard and in much less use than it was many years ago. And originalism is taken as a reasonable, defensible method of interpretation. And even the left tries to argue these days using originalism. And so I think that the work that you've done, Justice, has been enormously important in moving the legal culture in a positive direction. Also, I would say that Justice Scalia has been a wonderful friend to the Federalist Society from its very beginnings, when he was a faculty member at the University of Chicago Law School. He advised our founders, David McIntosh and Lee Liberman Otis and the others, to take this organization to the road in a way that that brings us here today. And if it weren't for Justice Scalia's encouragement and moral support, I'm not sure this organization would be anywhere near where it is today. So without further delay, it is my privilege to welcome Justice Antonin Scalia.
Oh, don't do it again. Thank you. Thank you, Leonard. That's a gross exaggeration. This organization was destined to be successful. I just happened to be around when it started and was the faculty sponsor at the University of Chicago. If anyone's been responsible for its great success, it is you, Leonard, who have really brought it out. As you heard, I was present at the birth. The Federalist Society is about the law. And the law is process. It's not substance. If you believe in the rule of law, you don't necessarily believe in any particular substantive thing. You believe in process. In a democracy, law is, of course, the process by which the will of the majority is given effect. That's what majority means. That's what democracy means. In a liberal democracy, of course, there are some limitations upon the will of the majority. Most of those in our system are contained in the Bill of Rights. That system works well when the exceptions that are contained in the Bill of Rights are given the meaning that the people understood when they created those exceptions. Because, of course, in a democracy, the exceptions have to be created by the people. It was the people who adopted the Bill of Rights. The system does not work well when the exceptions are given by some other institution a meaning that the people did not understand when they adopted the exceptions. When, for example, the people's agreement that the people shall not deny equal protection of the laws, when that phrase is held to mean that society must have same-sex marriage. There are arguments to be made for same-sex marriage, I suppose. But that's a substantive decision. But as far as the process is concerned, to impose that upon the society when the people have never voted to make that an exception of the from the majority's will is simply not the process that ought to exist. Unsurprisingly, then, the Federalist Society has been, as you heard in Leonard's remarks, well disposed towards originalism. Leonard speaks as though I invented the notion. Of course, I didn't invent it. It used to be orthodoxy. But it was an orthodoxy that gave life to the founders' vision of democracy, in which the people govern themselves and the people decide the exceptions from self-government. It is a different system entirely when one comes to believe in constitutional provisions that are not static, that do not mean what the people understood when they adopted them, but rather morph from generation to generation. Somebody has to decide when they morph and how they morph, and that person won't be the people. It'll be a court. It's a conceivable system. We ought to invent a name for it. It isn't democracy. How have the fortunes of originalism fared in the time since the Federalist Society was founded, the time when I was still a professor at the University of Chicago? Well, first of all, in the academy, I used to be able to say with a good deal of truth that one could fire a cannon loaded with grape shot in the faculty lounge of any law school in the country and not strike an originalist. That's no longer true. As Leonard intimated, originalism, which was once orthodoxy, at least has now been returned to the status of respectability. And there are originalists on the faculty of many, many law schools, three at Harvard, for example. So it's fared well in the academy. It has not particularly fared well at my old school, I'm sorry to say. Chicago, as far as I know, does not have an originalist on the faculty, has succeeded in its ambition to make itself like all other law schools, only by the time it did, they have changed. How has it fared in the courts? Well, read the opinions of the late 70s and the 80s. They're full of legislative history, but they're not very full of originalism. Constitutional cases are decided by describing the last case decided by the Supreme Court, and then reasoning from that to whatever the court considers the proper result to be. That has changed. Several terms ago, the opinion reinstating the original meaning of the Confrontation Clause was a thoroughly originalist opinion. And you all know about it, so I won't describe it to you. Just last term, the Heller case involving the Second Amendment. Not only was the majority opinion originalist, so were the dissents. So maybe the original meaning of the Constitution is back. We can disagree on what the original meaning is, of course, but we ought to have a system in which we all agree upon what we're looking for when we interpret a text. This is not an area where you want to let 1,000 flowers bloom. We should not be proud of the fact that we don't agree upon what we're looking for when we interpret our Constitution. That's not a satisfactory system. Anyway, we're not back there yet, but maybe we're on the way. I've noted many times that it's hard to get back to where we were because the philosophy of the living Constitution, which means it doesn't mean what the people agreed to when they adopted it, is a very seductive theory. It's seductive for judges because it empowers them. It's seductive for law professors because it lets law professors let their imaginations run wild. So it'll be hard to get back there, but we're on the road, and it's a fight worth making. Even if we're not successful, a thing worth doing. One of my favorite Chestertonian paradoxes: a thing worth doing is worth doing badly. I have to make one exception to the improvement of situations in the courts. I think United States courts have improved, but over the last few decades, the contagion of living constitutionalism has spread abroad. Canada adopted a Bill of Rights, which it soon interpreted to be a living tree, echoes of our living Constitution. The Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, which interprets the Convention on Human Rights of the European Nations, announced quite early on in its life that the convention was to be interpreted currently according to the needs of the current time. Essentially, it also is a living document. That, by the way, is why courts of other countries interpret the cite American Supreme Court cases, and why some American Supreme Court cases cite the courts of other countries. Because if in fact we're not looking for what a particular text meant when it was adopted, but rather we're looking for what that text ought to mean in the world we now live in, then what other courts think is indeed relevant. You know, they're smart fellas over there. So why shouldn't we? I mean, after all, when they were writing a constitution rather than interpreting one, the framers cited international examples repeatedly. Read the Federalist Papers. So why, if a court is rewriting a constitution rather than interpreting one, it should logically do the same. So that's what's been happening both in this country and abroad. I feel a little guilty about our being the originator of this disease, but indeed I have. You know, I don't think for many of the countries of the world the text even matters anymore. What has happened can only be compared with the naive belief that we used to have in the common law. You recall before Erie Railroad versus Tompkins, we really believed that there was a common law, the common law. And every state was trying to grasp its reality. Some of them got it wrong, but they were all engaged in the same enterprise. And so they'd cite each other, right? New York would cite Georgia. California would cite New York. Because we're all looking for the same thing. Well, Erie Railroad, you know, blows that away. Holmes, you know, says that there's no brooding omnipresence of the common law up there. What's going on is that each state is adopting its own domestic common law through the adjudicative system, and we all understand that, and we sort of chuckle at how naive the world could have been ever to have thought there was a common law up there. The common law has been replaced by human rights, capital H, capital R. There is a belief throughout the world that judges, somehow, are charged with protecting human rights in the abstract, never mind the text of a particular constitutional guarantee. When one puts on a black robe, one becomes charged with protecting human rights. As though we all agree as to what human rights are. There's enormous disagreement. And to give the responsibility of determining the meaning of that abstract phrase to unelected magistrates is anti-democratic. Those are the only prepared remarks I've had, and they haven't even been very much prepared. I told Leonard I'd take a Q&A afterwards, or I would take questions. We will certainly have Q. We will not necessarily have A.
Note cards have been passed around. If you have a question, I have some here, but if you have a question, please feel free to fill one out, and we have staff and volunteers collecting them. Okay, first question. Would the U.S. legal system suffer from less judicial activism if our judges were not allowed to sign their majority, concurring, or dissenting opinions?
That's an interesting concept, a very interesting concept. I don't think so. You know, most countries of the world don't have signed opinions. Do you think that they're less activist? The Court of Human Rights does not have signed opinions. They're at least as activist as we are. Our system was created by John Marshall, and I think the effect of it is to, if anything, to make the judges more responsible. You know who to blame. You know, you can... You can carry a sign, impeach Scalia. I think that produces more rather than less responsibility. It's always easier to hide behind a committee product. You can make it as kooky as you like. I don't know who to blame it on. You might even have dissented, right? It's good to know who to blame, I think.
What is the greatest theoretical difficulty with originalism, and how do you respond to it?
The greatest theoretical difficulty?
I didn't write the question.
Okay. Well, you know, the greatest practical difficulty is that sometimes it's very hard to figure out what the framers thought of a particular phenomenon. That's not as big a difficulty as one might suppose, because with respect to the most controversial matters, at least, it's always quite clear what the framers thought. You know, whether the death penalty is constitutional, whether there's a constitutional right to abortion, all of those things. There's no doubt what the society that adopted the amendments which are invoked to produce those results thought about those things. That is a practical difficulty. I suppose if there is any theoretical difficulty, I don't consider it a difficulty, but people point out that you can't play originalism, what should I say, straight. There are new phenomena that come into existence, And not only is it difficult to know what the framers thought of those phenomena, it is impossible to know because they were not around at the time. The case I always use as an example is New York versus Saya, which was in the 20s when sound trucks first came into use. New York City enacted an ordinance prohibiting the use of sound trucks after 10 o'clock. Very sensible ordinance. It was contended that violated the First Amendment. What did the framers think of sound trucks? I had no idea. And for those things, you have to sort of calculate the trajectory of the First Amendment. You know what the framers thought about this. You know what they thought about it. Where does this fall within all of that? And we know that the framers, that there was a doctrine of nuisance at the time of the framing, and that excessive noise could be nuisance. So I don't think it's hard to get a result in those cases. But don't pretend that there's always an answer out there. It's going to take some judicial judgment with respect to new phenomena. How does the First Amendment apply to the Internet? Things of that sort. That's probably the principal theoretical difficulty. But, you know, as difficult as that is, we still have a lot of answers. A lot easy. Whereas the other system, which says, oh, the Constitution changes and it's up to the judges to say what it means, they really have no answers. There is no criterion for when it changes and how it changes. Every day's a new day. So, you know, some of my colleagues have, you know, said they agonize a lot. I don't agonize at all. Sometimes it's hard to follow, you know, to find the answer in the record of history, but I don't agonize. You agonize when you, should there be a right to this or a right to that? And although we said a short time ago that there's no right to suicide or to assistance in suicide, we may revisit that, in the fullness of time. Every day's a new day. Last year, the death penalty was constitutional. I have to worry about whether it's still constitutional next year. So whatever our problems are, they pale into insignificance, I think, next to the problems of the living Constitution.
What, if anything, can law schools do to make better advocates?
Well, I have to say I'm sort of old school. I really think what law schools do best is to teach a body of knowledge, number one, and the process of analysis, two. And there's nowhere else you can get those things. You can learn a lot of the other things by sitting around a courtroom. You will never learn a cohesive body of knowledge, what the law of bankruptcy is. And you will never learn how to think like a lawyer unless you're trained to do that in law school. I do think it's useful and necessary for lawyers to... what was the question? It was about trial practice in particular?
Well, it doesn't say. It says an advocate, so...
Advocate. Okay. Well, of course, that's important. What's important is that law schools know that that's what they're doing, that they're training advocates, that they're not training other law professors. And this pretense that somehow being a law professor and studying the law is a noble thing, but the practice of law is a demeaning exercise. I mean, that's foolish. Law school is not a trade school, but it is a professional school, and the profession that almost all of the people who go to law school intend to practice is the profession of law. I have come to be a believer that good trial practice can be taught, because I've sat in on some sessions and I said, my God, that's brilliant. I would have done it the other way. So law schools can teach trial practice by, to tell you the truth, the best way to do it is to bring in adjuncts who do it all the time. But there are some professors, I'm sure, who specialize in trial practice. Anyway, my point is, I don't know how, but they should want to do it, okay?
Now, I'm assuming from the tenor of this next question, this is something you've said about yourself, so I'll
I have said it
that way. Why are you a faint-hearted originalist?
Oh, my, I said that a long time ago. I said in the course of I guess it was a law review piece, that, you know, if you're an originalist, you would have to say that the Eighth Amendment Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause does not prohibit the cutting off of ears or the notching of ears, which is the way in the framing generation felons used to be identified. Criminals, they would notch the ears. And they would, you know, they would inflict corporal punishment, lashes and so forth. Now, I suppose that I have to say that is not unconstitutional. And if I had a case right in front of me, at that time at least, I said, you know, I'm not sure. Maybe I'm too faint-hearted to say that. But I've gotten older and crankier. And I mean, I don't like that stuff, but and the more horrible you make the example, the less likely it is to occur. I'm not really worried that people are going to start notching ears. So, you know, it's just sort of an academic question invented to embarrass originalists. And if it's given to you, you say, yes, it's not unconstitutional. Now, it is stupid, but not unconstitutional. Oh, that... some of you have heard my... I should remember the name of the Court of Appeals judge who had the idea. But he suggested that all federal judges should be issued, upon their taking the oath of office, a stamp pad and a rubber stamp. And what they do is you whack it on the stamp pad and you hit the paper, and what the stamp says is, stupid but constitutional. Whack! Stupid but constitutional. Whack! Stupid but constitutional. The notion that everything that is stupid is unconstitutional is probably the besetting sin of judges. Anyway.
How does natural law fit with originalism?
Natural law has nothing to do with originalism. I mean, I believe in natural law, but unfortunately, I have no way to show that, demonstrate that my understanding of it is the same as yours, or is the same as anybody else's. I don't enforce natural law. I suppose God enforces natural law. I enforce United States law. And that United States law should not contravene natural law. But that's not my problem. It's the problem of whoever enacted United States law. Now, if I were in the legislature, I would have to worry all the time about natural law. But where I'm sitting now, I don't worry about it. I worry about what does this text mean? As far as I know, there's nothing in the Constitution that contravenes natural law. In fact, I'm certain there's nothing there that contravenes it. Or at least my notion of natural law.
How often are the votes of justices changed by discussion amongst them in judicial conference?
Not very often. I'm not giving away... the secrets of the Supreme Court, because the former Chief Justice, Chief Justice Rehnquist, wrote a book on the court in which he said that the conference on cases is really misnamed. It's not really a conference.
in which people try to persuade each other. It's a statement of each justice's views on the case. This is how I see the case, and this is how I vote. We go around the table. And when John Paul Stevens is setting forth his view of the case, I would not interrupt and say, wait, John, why do you say that? You know, you're sure that... You know, the Chief Justice would say to me, you know, you'll have your turn. John is talking. Let him finish. we go all around the table. Then after we've gone around the table, anybody who wants to respond to John or respond to somebody else can. But you know, it's pretty much everybody's mind is made up when you go in. It is not an exercise in persuasion. So if you have this vision of nine philosopher kings sitting about... ordering the world, you're just wrong. In the days when we had, we were deciding 150 cases a term, which is more than we can do well, we used to have a Friday conference at which we would discuss the cases decided Tuesday and Wednesday. And there used to be four cases on Tuesday and four on Wednesday. We would discuss and vote on eight cases and also dispose of the cert petitions that had accumulated that week or sometimes for 2 weeks. I guess, no, always just 1 week. And we would be done by lunch. So banish from your mind the notion of philosophers probing the depths of stuff.
Would the federal judicial confirmations process be less contentious or politicized if names were submitted by a bipartisan commission who would forward those slate of nominees to the president? And you can use the question if you want more generally to talk about the confirmation process, obviously.
Well, I don't know. I guess the bipartisan commission proceedings would be as controversial as the confirmation proceedings now are. But I think it would last right into the confirmation proceedings. If whoever comes out of that process is... what's going on is quite simply the consequence of a Supreme Court that is... rewriting the Constitution. It is the consequence of the living Constitution. It is a consequence of the Constitution that changes. And the Constitution for whose changes the court is responsible. Once the people figured out that that's what's going on, it took them maybe 30 years or so to figure that out. The people aren't stupid. And they say, well, we used to look for good lawyers. Somebody with a modicum of judicial demeanor, an honest person, all this stuff, that's not the most important thing anymore. This court is rewriting the Constitution. I should pick somebody who will write the new Constitution that I like. Isn't that inevitable once you know what the job is? I think it's inevitable, and I think the process will remain that contentious as long as the court stays with the relatively new notion of a living constitution.
What should Federalist Society law students do in the face of intolerant or militant law professors and peers?
Well... this would only apply to Catholic law students. My mother used to say, offer it up. Well, it's tricky. I guess if you think the professor is not a mean and spiteful person, you should defend the other side in class discussion. And most of the professors I know would not punish you. In fact, they would welcome somebody, on the other side that can serve as a foil because they'll think they can beat you. And that's why they publish my dissents. Why do you think they put my dissents in the case books? Because... because you need something to create an interesting discussion. So most of them won't resent that. But, you know, if you think the professor will mark you down for it, then I don't think you can be criticized for sitting silently and gnashing your teeth. The harder question is, what do I do when I come to writing the exam? Okay. Do I give him the answer he taught me to be the right answer? Yeah, you give him the answer. He taught me to be the right answer.
Live for another day.
Yes. Wily as a serpent, right?
What rule or rules do you apply when deciding to set aside a precedent when reviewing a case that you feel was wrongly decided?
Oh, well, when I urge originalism as the interpretive norm, I don't mean that I'm going to go back and rip out every case over the last 30, 35 years that has not been decided on an originalist basis. I would not. I believe in stare decisis, and the vast majority of that stuff is water under the bridge, and I wouldn't go back and revise it. Or, as I often say, I am a textualist, I am an originalist, I am not a nut. There are some opinions that I do not accept. I think the most important criteria for me are probably in ascending order. Number one, how wrong was it? I mean, there are some of them that are blatantly and maliciously wrong. Okay. Number two, how well has it been accepted? You know, when I was in law school, the incorporation doctrine was still controversial, the doctrine that the 14th Amendment caused the Bill of Rights to be applicable to the states, which it never was before. I think that's probably wrong, but I wouldn't go back and try to, you know, it's been widely accepted now. I'm not about to tell the people of New York State that their state government is not bound by the First Amendment. I mean, you know, they would be hell to pay. Lastly, and probably for me most important, does that prior decision allow me to behave like a judge, which is to say, behave like a lawyer? Is it, for example, like Casey, the reincarnation of Roe versus Wade? Does it ask me to decide whether a particular disposition by state law places an undue burden on the woman's constitutional right to abortion? What am I supposed to do with that? You know, being a lawyer, I would run to the law books. The United States reports, what do you know? For 200 years, no burden was an undue burden. Well, how do I decide that question? Now, how will the court decide it? I guarantee. Let's assume it's a Virginia, some state law that requires a certain staffing at all abortion facilities. So many doctors, so many nurses, and also certain machines that are very expensive. And all of this increases the cost of abortion considerably. Does this place an undue burden? What do you think we're going to talk about if you're a fly on the wall? I assure you it'll go like, eight doctors, three nurses. I don't think that's an undue burden. You think it's an undue burden? How many think it's an undue burden? It's not law. And I don't mean,
I don't mean to deprecate the importance of deciding that question. Somebody has to decide it. I think a legislature has to decide whether there is a right to abortion, and if there is, what's an undue burden upon it? The legislature. Because it's a policy judgment. It's not a legal judgment. What are you giving it to a lawyer for? So that's criterion number three, which is to say number one for me, the most important one. I won't accept any prior decision that casts me in a role of policymaker rather than lawyer.
Do you think that there is a threat to judicial independence in our country?
I think there is a considerable threat to the quality of the federal courts, which I think were the best courts the world has ever seen. I truly believe that. Awfully well qualified people, awfully good judges. What has happened is that the nature of the people coming into the courts has changed considerably. I really think that the principal difference between the common law system and the civil law system is precisely the nature of the judges. It's not the process. I mean, you know, in the old days they always had a text and we were thinking about the common law. That's not. I mean, the common law is gone. Federal courts never applied the common law, and even in the state courts, it's mostly codified now. Almost always there's a text in front of us, just as there's a text in front of the civilian lawyers. So that's not the difference. Nor is the substantive result different. I mean, we come to about the same results that we use in contracts, the doctrine of consideration. They don't have that, but they have other gimmicks that produce about the same consequence. No, but the big difference between the two is the nature of the judge. The French, before they adopted our system themselves, used to criticize it as le gouvernement des juges, government by the judges. That is our system of judicial review of legislative action. Le gouvernement des juges. I never realized how contemptuous that was until I got to understand what a French juge was. When you get out of the university with a degree in law, you pick your career. If you want to go to private practice, you go that way. If you want to go to diplomatic service, you go that way. If you want to go to the courts, you immediately become a baby judge in some very small court. And if you keep your nose clean and don't make waves, you are promoted by a panel of judges. Your whole life you have had your snout in the public trough, and you have come to believe that the government is good, capital G. Contrast that with the typical common law judge, not just here, but in England as well, where being a judge in a major court is the capstone of a successful legal career, where you have not only not been working for the government, you've been suing the government. You've been defending clients against the government in criminal cases. Totally different mindset. Totally different mindset. And that's the big difference between our two systems. And that difference is beginning to disappear because of a number of factors, one of which, and a significant one of which, is ridiculously low judicial salaries. The number of people going into the judiciary, federal judiciary, from the private practice, you can see a graph. It goes down like that. And the graph going up is those who have never had private practice. They've been an assistant U.S. attorney, then they become perhaps a judge on a minor state court, then they become a magistrate judge, a bankruptcy judge, right up through the system. That will kill us. It will make us a different country. Really will. The year I was appointed to the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, My daughter Catherine was visiting relatives of her German professor in a little town in Germany. And she's there the first night at dinner, and they ask her what her father does. And she says, he is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Oh, how exciting. They're enormously impressed. And then she continued, since my nomination to the D.C. Circuit was pending, she continues with great pride, but he is going to become a federal court of appeals judge. Their faces dropped. What had the man done to disgrace himself in this fashion? Being a professor of law to being a judge. And whenever I traveled in Europe, I was not Judge Scalia. I was Professor Scalia. It was much more prestigious.
Has the Supreme Court been injecting itself into the business of foreign policy making?
No. That's one I won't answer. I don't. Okay. I disagreed with some of our decisions. I'm not sure I'd put it that way. I'd put it the Supreme Court has, in those cases where I've dissented, it seems to me that the court did not follow what the treaty required, what the Constitution traditionally had been known to require, or what the law requires. But I'm not going to make a wholesale indictment such as that.
What do you make of the argument that legal reasoning is really a fig leaf? That is, a pretextual reliance on legal reasoning actually provides cover for and a greater amount of non-restrained judicial decision-making. Why not just acknowledge that judges do and should consider the consequences of their possible decisions in a case?
Because I don't do that. Because I often come to results that I don't like. I used to be the editor of Regulation Magazine at the American Enterprise Institute, which was devoted to deregulation, to pointing out the stupidities of regulation and how much better things would work if you let the market sort out most of these things, not everything, but most of them. And yet, while sitting on the D.C. Circuit and at the Supreme Court, I have prevented deregulation by agencies who wanted to eliminate, for example, the filing of tariffs. Now, I think the filing of tariffs was a very stupid idea. Unfortunately, the statute required it. Oh, I mean, I think any good judge comes to decisions that he does not like, he or she does not like. Now, I suppose there are judges who just think that their role is to make the law rather than apply the law that the people have made through their representatives. That's a bad judge. But don't curse the whole corps of judges with that. And when you say stuff like that, you give them cover. You give them cover. No, that's not what good judges do. And any judge that does it should be ashamed.
And this, I think, will be the last question, Justice.
Make it easy.
Good. Sorry.
Make it easy.
Give me a minute.
you can make it like Strom Thurmond's first question to me when I was up for my confirmation. It was wonderful. The Republicans happened to be in charge of the Senate, and Strom was the chairman of the committee, and the first question he asked me, he says, "Now, Judge Scalia, what do you think of judicial activism?"
Yeah, let me have that one, Senator. I'm ready for that. I'm ready for that pitch.
make it easy like that.
Well, it's about two opinions you've written, so it'll be easy. How do you reconcile your concurrence in Reich v. Gonzalez and your joining the majority in Lopez?
Oh, no, I'm not going to that. Get another question.
Another question? Okay. What is your favorite opera?
Yeah, I wonder if any real opera lover can tell you, you know, my favorite opera. I bet you not many can. I think it would be impossible. They're so different one from another. I mean, I like Rosenkavalier, certainly one of my very favorites. So is, Butterfly. So is Traviata. No, I can't tell you. And I like country music too. So.